You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of IAS 2007, the fourth International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Pathogenesis, Treatment, and Prevention. Sydney, Australia, July 22nd through July 25th, 2007.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the Body Pros coverage of the fourth International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Pathogenesis, Treatment, and Prevention, known as IAS 2007, which is now taking place in Sydney, Australia. This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of The Body Pro. I'm here with Dr. Daniel Berger, Medical Director of North Star Healthcare in Chicago and a Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Welcome, Dr. Berger.
Thanks, Bonnie. It's great to be here.
Well, the first day of IAS has come and gone. It's been chock full of interesting presentations, from aging and HIV to hepatitis C co-infection. Dr. Berger, what did you take away from this first day of the conference?
Before every conference, physicians have expectations regarding some of the clinical controversies and questions that we know we'll be hearing about during the meeting. The morning started with the traditional plenary session. The first presentation, which was given by Deborah Work-Zudi, director of the World Bank Global HIV Program, was appropriately centered around the dramatic problems and challenges of the developing world. During the first few minutes, the audience was taken by a litany of dire statistics. There was one rather horrific statistic stated, 70% of people in South Africa and Ethiopia will die of AIDS before ever receiving treatment. Some solutions were proposed, including setting up multiple infrastructures for clinical trials within these impoverished communities, providing an organizational approach for standardized care in these countries. My focus here is on clinical research, so I'll not further discuss this rather overwhelming issue because of the time limitations during this broadcast. In an ironic juxtaposition, another talk in the same plenary focused on an issue that is only occurring in the developed world, and that is the growing population of HIV-infected people who are aging. Brian Gazzard of Chelsea Westminster Hospital gave an overview on the subject and looked at the question of whether HIV-infected patients will live a normal lifespan. It was a real wake-up call, for instance, to hear that one-third of HIV-positive patients in the UK are older than age 55. Gazzard showed that with each year on heart, the lifespan of someone with HIV continues to improve. However, despite treatment, lifespans do not reach that of what is being observed for uninfected people. Some of the diseases of aging, such as dementia, atherosclerosis, loss of bone mineral density, hepatic and renal disease, and cancer, are seen at an increased incidence in chronic HIV infection. However, heart tends to control end organ disease, as demonstrated surprisingly by the SMART study in 2006. In the SMART study, patients who were on continuous therapy versus episodic treatment interruptions had less cardiovascular, renal, and hepatic complications. This revealed that it is HIV that is the culprit for these complications and not suspected previously antiretroviral drugs, thus making treatment interruptions not a recommended intervention because of the greater risks associated with it. In regards to the prevention of cardiovascular disease and cancer, clinicians have a role. With up to 40 to 50% of HIV-infected patients believed to be still smoking, we should be talking to our patients about smoking cessation as much as we talk about other HIV-related subjects. The DAD study, published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, showed smoking to be the major factor for increased cardiovascular disease in our patients. In regards to aging and malignancies, a loss of immune surveillance has led to an increase in non-AIDS-related cancers. Several abstracts today show changes in the types and rates of various malignancies during the late heart era. Prior to protease inhibitors and optimized treatment, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and primary CNS lymphoma, as well as Kaposi sarcoma, were seen in the clinic often. Several fairly large studies at the conference examined the change and range of the new cancers that are being observed at increased rates. This shift in trend, as described by Andrew Grulich today and mentioned by Gazzard, noted that these malignancies often originate from infectious pathogens. For example, increases in anal and genital cancers are related to human papillomavirus, hepatocellular cancers related to chronic hepatitis, Epstein-Barr virus infection gives rise to Hodgkin's disease, and Helicobacter pylori to stomach cancer. In Grulich's abstract, HIV-infected patients were compared to transplant patients, and Grulich found that the above malignancies are generally more common now and are HIV-infected patients than in transplant recipients, both populations being immune deficient. In another poster today, this one by Nancy Crum, it was noted that these new malignancies are occurring in patients on optimally suppressive regimens and higher CD4 counts averaging 440 CD4 cells.
So I guess it's logical to ask, are these cancers becoming more common simply because HIV-infected patients are living longer?
Probably not, since there is evidence that the incidence of certain malignancies are more common in HIV-infected patients when compared to HIV-uninfected general population. In another poster, Priti Patel from the U.S. Centers of Disease Control and Prevention showed these comparisons and noted that 7 non-AIDS cancers were elevated, and anal cancers in particular are increasing at a greater rate in HIV-infected people. I think the take-home has to be that because these non-AIDS-related malignancies are increasing at a greater rate in HIV-infected patients, we need to find a better screening method. For example, we can do more frequent anal exams on our patients with HIV, so we can be proactive if we catch it early. And as mentioned, we could focus more on smoking cessation.
There was so much today about hepatitis co-infection. Can you discuss some of the bigger issues?
One of the biggest stories to come out of the conference today concerns the HIV and hepatitis co-infected population. Today there was an entire oral session plus a poster session devoted to this subject. As clinicians, we have been seeing more of our HIV-infected patients become Hep C co-infected. Once thought to be rare, there is now strong evidence that Hep C is transmitted sexually, at least in men who have sex with men, or MSMs as we call it. We have first heard about this in a study from the Swiss cohort presented in 2005. This study showed a dramatic incidence in Hep C co-infection. 1,500 new Hep C seroconversions occurred during the study. These seroconversions occurred in HIV-infected MSMs who were initially Hep C negative without reported injection drug use. Another article in AIDS by Gotz appeared during the same time. 41% of HIV-positive MSMs in this cohort seroconverted to Hep C virus, where parenteral risk factors and injection drug use were excluded. And in a poster presentation today, Julie Fox reported a group of patients that were identified to be an acute primary HIV infection diagnosed as Hep C positive at the same time. While Hep C continues to be on the rise, doctors managing treatment of patients with both infections are confronted with lots of questions and challenges. Patients with either Hep C and Hep B co-infection have a higher risk of progression to end-stage liver disease, as well as decreased tolerability to antiretrovirals. It is still undecided when is the best time to initiate treatment for Hep C for particular patients and on which therapy should be initiated first, HIV meds or hepatitis C. Also, another open question is which is the more liver-friendly heart regimen for these patients? As I mentioned previously, the growing prevalence rates of Hep C in the MSM population are due to many factors, including complacency because of the success of heart and less regard for safe sex practices. But in addition, we can't forget the epidemic of crystal methamphetamine use, largely in the MSM community. Crystal use has become a path for rapid destruction in the MSM community. It is used during circuit parties that take place around the world, in the MSM community, as well as internet hookups. As a result of all these factors, there has also been an upsurge in not only Hep C and HIV, but other STDs, including syphilis, which has been very much in the news lately. If more is not done to stop crystal methamphetamine use, the epidemic will only worsen.
Do you think, is it more unprotected sex that is causing hepatitis C transmission, or do you think there are particular alterations in sexual behavior?
Actually, one German poster presented today by A.J. Schmidt reported on behavioral changes within the MSM community and the contribution of substance abuse on aggressive sexual practices that have become more common. These included what these investigators called gangbanging or group sex, as well as barebacking or unprotected anal intercourse. Also described was bleeding anal injuries from various ways of sexual intercourse, such as fisting and foreign object insertions. Clearly, because the risks associated with more aggressive sexual practices, Hep C can be more easily transmitted. What I think is important for us to take home about this is that because we know that Hep C among our HIV-infected patients is increasing, physicians involved in the care of HIV-infected MSM population need to be vigilant for abnormal liver enzymes. Don't always presume that the somewhat elevated liver enzymes in your patient is due to antiretrovirals. Regular HCV and HBV screening should be performed and incorporated when routine testing for STDs are done to help reduce inadequate and late detection. Physicians should also educate patients about the risks.
So with hepatitis B and C on the rise, what does this mean in terms of treatment? I know there is a dire need for new hepatitis C treatments.
Current standard treatment for hep C involves a combination of pegylated interferon plus ribavirin. However, treatment is not well tolerated and is fraught with multiple side effects and often unsuccessful. During an oral session, Marion Peters provided a glimpse of various new HCV inhibitors attacking different agents within the hep C life cycle. Among these were protease inhibitors that show promise with good potency. She provided an interim analysis of a study with an hep C protease inhibitor called telaprevir, which is combined as triple therapy with pegylated interferon and ribavirin. The triple therapy markedly improved response rates at 12 weeks, and nearly 80% of patients achieved undetectable hep C RNA with the triple therapy, compared with dual therapy of interferon and ribavirin alone. Peter stated that since interferon appears to be synergistic with most anti-hep C compounds in the pipeline, and that interferon sensitivity is increased by these other agents, ribavirin and interferon will remain the mainstay of treatment combined with these newer agents. As mentioned at present, the treatment of hep C in the co-infected population is often unsuccessful, especially with the genotype 1A or 1B. So we're often confronted with not knowing what to do with the non-responders of anti-hep C therapy. One matched control study presented today by Anna DeBona of San Rafael Hospital in Milan showed that peg interferon plus ribavirin slowed down the rate of cirrhosis progression in the HIV hep C co-infected patients who were non-responders in comparison to the untreated patients. This is not new news, but it's part of a more mounting evidence of what we can do with our non-responder patients until newer therapies make their way down the pipeline.
Today we also saw quite a few studies mentioning hepatitis B co-infection, which affects approximately 10% of HIV-infected patients. Can you discuss some of the more interesting studies?
With only a limited choice of treatment for hep B, issues surrounding resistance to hep B are important. Hep B resistance is more serious than HIV, since there is only one viral target, the viral polymerase. Additionally, cross-resistance to certain available anti-hep B agents is not uncommon. During an oral presentation, Stephen Locarnini stated that lamivudine and adefovir appear to be the most susceptible to resistance development when used as monotherapy. Despite this, it is sad that anti-hep V clinical trials continue to be designed as monotherapy. On the other hand, entecavir appears to have the highest barrier for resistance. Also, administering two agents, such as tenofovir with emtricitabine, is more effective at achieving durable suppression of hep B DNA. During an animated presentation, Vincent Soriano reiterated this and described the combination of tenofovir and emtricitabine as magic for hepatitis B. Soriano also discussed a recent famous report of three HIV-infected patients not on antiviral therapy being treated for hep B with entecavir monotherapy. These individuals demonstrated a one-log reduction of HIV RNA with entecavir therapy. In one subject, the M184V mutation was isolated. Although Soriano seemed doubtful about this becoming a common problem, he stated that entecavir should not be used as monotherapy in the HIV co-infected patients that are not on antiviral therapy. In terms of treating their hepatitis B HIV co-infected patients, most HIV clinicians already understand the dangers of monotherapy, having experienced treatment failures prior to HART. One of the important take-home messages here was that chronic hep B progresses faster in HIV-infected patients. Treatment of hep B should be considered as a priority in HIV-infected patients. All hepatitis B HIV co-infected patients should be tested for viral genotype, quantitative hepatitis B viral DNA or hepatitis viral loads, and testing for liver fibrosis should also be performed.
In a completely different subject, as you know, many discordant heterosexual couples yearn to have their own children. A study presented today looked at natural conception for these couples. Can you tell us about this interesting study?
Currently, artificial techniques involving sperm washing, intrauterine insemination, and in vitro fertilization devices are not easily available. There are free clinics in the U.S. who will help these couples, even though sperm washing has been around for a while and sperm is easily shipped. The transport of which has already been perfected with bulls and bull sperm is widely available for breeding. Pietro Vernazza took a look at discordant couples who wanted to conceive naturally and have a child safely. In this small study, each member of the couple was counseled regarding the risks of HIV transmission with unprotected sex. The HIV-positive men were all on optimized treatment for at least 3 months prior to the study, and frequent measurements of urine luteinizing hormone, LH, from the women participants were done. When LH levels peaked, pre-exposure prophylaxis known as PrEP was administered as tenofovir to the 22 HIV-negative women twice, both 36 and 12 hours prior to a timed intercourse. In the study, more than 70% of the women became pregnant within 3 episodes of unprotected intercourse. Pregnancy rates in this study were significantly higher with natural intercourse than after artificial insemination. No women during the study seroconverted to HIV. This study is very interesting because it looked at this problem from a very practical standpoint. My concerns of the study is that actually when the other member is optimally suppressed, the rates of transmission is probably fairly low anyhow. So a study of only 22 individuals would not have enough power to evaluate whether this intervention was effective. An additional concern is that our current understanding of PrEP involves at least 2 antiviral drugs. Third, if the investigator provided more prolonged dosing of tenofovir, a standard steady state would be achieved and strict timing of intercourse would not be necessary so long as ovulation is occurring. Anyhow, I think this study provides for a tantalizing solution for discordant couples in this situation who wish to conceive. Further larger studies can confirm the safety and prevention of HIV transmission, since this natural method would be infinitely less expensive, easier, and more practical to perform than current assisted reproduction techniques.
Can you talk about the interesting data that was reported today out of the Danish post-exposure prophylaxis registry of their 10 years of experience using PEP, as it's called?
Yes. In this presentation, the researchers reported on more than 350 patients who were given PEP following a variety of homosexual and heterosexual exposure. Most, however, were from homosexual encounters and many for receptive anal intercourse. The researchers also reported on the incidence of PEP administration following occupational exposure, most being for percutaneous exposure from patients belonging to high-risk groups. The mean time for initiation of PEP in this retrospective study was quite rapid, about 10 hours after sexual exposure and 2 hours following occupational exposure. Over the 10 years, it appears that the administration of PEP has been increasing, although repeated PEP was rare. This, I hope, may relate to the fact that once an individual has experienced taking any viral drugs for a month, they have thought through their experience and made the right assessment to take precautions for the future. Increasing rates of PEP are similarly being observed in the U.S. at some sites. So how tolerable is PEP? A British study presented by David Hawkins discussed tolerability issues. In this study, AZT was replaced by D4T in a tenofovir-based regimen because of tolerability issues, such as increased anxiety and nausea. The issues brought up in these two studies were posed as good reminders that if you're going to administer PEP, it should be as quickly as possible after the possible exposure, and that the possible exposure itself should be evaluated carefully. Clearly, only people at high risk for HIV should be given PEP because of the potential side effects, and if PEP is prescribed, it should be done by a knowledgeable professional.
I know that testing for abacavir hypersensitivity reaction will be discussed in detail on Wednesday, but today there were quite a few posters about issues surrounding this. Can you summarize these posters?
One of the inhibitions for clinicians in prescribing abacavir is the hypersensitivity reaction, or HSR, in some patients. But this may become a fear of the past, since the development of a new genetic blood test that can be used to screen patients prior to treatment. We'll be hearing a lot more about this in Wednesday's session after 2 major studies called SHAPE and PREDICT will be presented. actually predict will be presented as a late breaker presentation. Today, however, there were some interesting posters of small studies looking at issues surrounding abacavir hypersensitivity and this new HLA-B5701 test. In addition to the new HLA test, a research tool being used, an abacavir patch test, confirms a tendency for an abacavir hypersensitivity reaction. But this patch test is only a research tool. But what is interesting about this test was shown in an abstract today by Elizabeth Phillips. She examined genetic characteristics of patients who were either abacavir patch test positive or patch test negative. What was interesting clinically about this small study was that there were 7 patch test negative patients who had suspected HSR in whom the investigators said had a clinical need to be on abacavir. So because the patch test was negative in these individuals, the patients were successfully re-challenged and re-established on the drug. The patch test should never be used as a tool, and re-challenge should never be performed with suspected abacavir HSR. The question in my mind was why the authors re-challenged these 7 patients. The reason I mention this is because there may be other mechanisms where a person can have a severe allergic reaction, and with the current availability of multiple new agents, this should not be a need to be dependent on abacavir if someone has suspected HSR. But as I mentioned, we'll be discussing HLA testing on Wednesday in detail.
I know today there weren't a lot of presentations about new drugs, but were there any agents in preclinical trials that looked interesting?
One interesting new agent involved the possible development of an oral bioavailable fusion inhibitor. This is especially important because infervitide, which has been instrumental in salvage regimens for patients with triple-class resistance, has been especially crucial. This was seen in various studies, including RESIST, POWER, and data from the benchmark trials, which showed that when infervitide was included as part of optimized background, there was a significant improvement leading to more patients achieving viral load suppression. However, infervitide has to be administered by subcutaneous injection, and patients must self-inject twice daily and also deal with those pesky injection site reactions. CCR5 inhibitors were thought to perhaps replace fusion inhibitors. However, they are still being discussed regarding what role they will play, and none have been currently approved yet. So during fusion, the HIV glycoprotein envelope undergoes conformational changes after interacting with the CD4 and co-receptors, forming what's called a 6-helix bundle structure. This drives fusion of HIV onto the target membrane or CD4 T-cell. These conformational changes occurring on the envelope provides for researching of another target and drugs that work via this mechanism to inhibit fusion. Unlike infervitide, these compounds affect GP120 conformational changes and bind to the envelope prior to receptor engagement. Because of this new mechanism, these compounds should be active against most infervitide-resistant viruses. They also have the potential for oral bioavailability, so that patients can hope to eventually forego the injections of infervitide.
Well, we really look forward to hearing more about new drugs in the coming days. So thank you, Dr. Berger, for a very comprehensive overview of today's session of IAS 2007.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on IAS 2007 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/IAS2007.